You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and RadioCafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. What is the internet doing to our brains? Is it making us smarter? Is it making us dumber? One of the people who knows most about this topic is author Nicholas Carr, whose book, The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains, was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. He's going to be in Santa Fe soon, and we'll be talking to him right after this message. The Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation is providing career pathway scholarships for current high school seniors and anyone else who has earned a high school diploma or GED to help fund an associate's degree or professional certification. Residents of seven counties in northern New Mexico may apply at lanlfoundation.org/scholarships, lanlfoundation.org/scholarships. The deadline is May 31st. I'm very happy now to welcome Nicholas Carr. He's an award-winning and best-selling author of five books, including the Pulitzer Prize finalist, The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains. He will be speaking on Thursday, May 23rd at 6:30 at the James A. Little Theater at the New Mexico School for the Deaf. The talk is titled Minds in the Net, The Journey from Page to Screen. It's sponsored by the School for Advanced Research. Welcome, Nicholas Carr, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. My pleasure.
So I've been reading your book, The Shallows, which I think everybody should read, especially if they use the internet. And it's about the effect of the internet on people, on our brains and minds and lives. You write about the brain's neuroplasticity, which is basically the fact that our brains are incredibly adaptable, which is a great thing. It means we can keep learning and changing our whole lives. And at the same time, some of those changes aren't necessarily for the better. Let's start with the question of how our experience of reading has changed with the internet. What's the difference between reading a book or magazine or scholarly article on paper versus reading it online?
I mean, the main difference is that the printed book, the traditional book, in a sense, helps screen out distractions and interruptions. It turns out that reading deeply or paying attention to anything deeply doesn't come naturally to human beings. It's something we have always struggled with because our brains are adapted to kind of scanning the environment and picking up on drawing in new information. And so I think one of the great things about the printed page is that it focuses our attention on the words. Nothing else is going on the page other than the words. So it encourages us to not only to read deeply, but I believe to build up our powers of attention. It's kind of a way to train our minds. You can put that same text, those same words, onto a screen, a computer screen or a smartphone screen or whatever. And the problem is that the screen is designed to distract us and interrupt us and provide us with lots of notifications. We know there's all sorts of other things we could be doing when we're trying to read on a screen. And so as a result, I think it gets in the way, the screen actively gets in the way of our ability to read deeply and encourages us to revert to this very kind of primitive way of using our mind where we're constantly taking in new bits of information in lots of different ways, but we're not calming our mind down and really focusing.
There is a kind of a paradox in that, on the one hand, there's so much material accessible on the internet, so you don't have to spend hours or days or even weeks looking for stuff at the library. Now we can find it all in an instant. We can read it in our own time. So you would think that would make people, I mean, even despite the distractions, it would make people be able to go deeper in their research, whether they're scholars or journalists or whatever, and especially scholars who were an obsessive and disciplined bunch, you know, who have trained their minds in certain ways. And yet the opposite is happening. It has not led to depth. What's going on? What does that look like and what's happening?
Well, I think it's a good thing that we have access to all this information. Whenever we get a new communication technology or research technology that opens up more sources of information, I think in general, that's a good thing, and it's hard to argue against that. And I think up until recently, all of us, or most people anyway, have kind of thought that all you need is access to lots of information, and that's going to make you broader minded or more knowledgeable. What that misses is that just as important, or even more important than the volume and speed of information delivery, is the way the information is presented to us. Because what happens is we're overwhelmed by information when we're online. And as a result, we aren't able to transform information into knowledge. Because it's important to draw a distinction. It's not just little bits of information that makes us smart, and certainly it's not that makes us wise. It's the ability to think deeply about that information, concentrate on it, attend to it. And it's only when we're thinking deeply that we create all sorts of associations and connections between a new piece of information coming into our mind and everything else we know. And it's those connections and associations that are the essence of intelligence and knowledge. And when we're constantly bombarded by information, we short circuit our ability to create knowledge. So it's great that we have all this information. What's really bad is that the second step in creating knowledge, which is thinking deeply and attentively, contemplatively, reflectively, that's all short circuited by the technology.
I was talking to my husband yesterday over breakfast about your books. He's a classical guitarist. He teaches music. And he said that for him, the proliferation of information on the internet leads to the need for more teachers rather than fewer, because it's that much harder for students to sort through the information overload. And there's sort of like a, oh, we won't need teachers or universities anymore because it's all there. But it may be the opposite.
That's what I think. There was all this, you know, talk about how we won't need actual living teachers, we won't need librarians because people will just have all this information at their fingertips. And I think the reason that's not true is very much related to what I've been talking about, that in order to make sense of new pieces of information, you have to put that information into a bigger context. And, you know, one of the reasons we go to school, one of the reasons we look to teachers and experts is they help us build that context so that the new information makes sense and isn't just this blur of messages and notifications. So I think that the kind of overload we all feel, thanks to the internet, thanks to our phones, really makes it all the more important, A, that we have times during the day and times at school when we are encouraged to pay attention, when we have people who have, you know, that's their goal, to teach us how to think deeply and attentively. People like teachers and librarians. So I do think that their role becomes more and more important, not less so. They're not rendered obsolete by simply having Google at your fingertips.
One of the things that I think is really interesting and important about your work is that you talk about the metaphors we use to think about ourselves. And a lot of our metaphors are mechanistic and technological. The idea that we are essentially machines, that our brains are quote unquote hardwired for certain things, that we have to clear a space on our brain's hard disk to make room for something new. But these metaphors aren't necessarily accurate, and there are better ones. Talk about that.
We seem to have this desire to take the latest technology and use it as a metaphor for the way our brains work. And this goes all the way back. I think it's Aristotle who talks about the brain working like fountains in royal palaces, you know, something that a fairly new technology at the time. And then when the mechanical clock and watches are invented, which wasn't that long ago, 500, 600 years ago, people start talking about the brain working like clockwork. When we have the Industrial Revolution, people start having this very mechanical view of the brain. And now with the computer, we hear, as you pointed out, this assumption that our brains are somehow working like computers. This is, by the way, not only a popular metaphor, but it's kind of, I think people in Silicon Valley kind of literally believe it, or at least wish it to be true. So there's this idea that the faster, just like a computer, you want lots of information going in and coming out, input, output. There's this view that, you know, the more information we can put into our brain as quickly as possible, the better computations we'll have. The problem with that is that the brain doesn't work like that. The brain is an organic, biological part of our body. And if you look at how the brain operates, it really there's all sorts of genetic signals and neurochemical signals and this close attachment to our senses. So there is this sense, this very organic sense to how we take in information, how we learn. And it seems to me that the mistake and the danger of simply saying, oh, our brains are like computers, is that gives you the impression that you don't have to learn anything anymore. You don't have to create your own base of knowledge in your brain, because if our brain's like a computer, then getting information off the web and from Google and from Facebook is just as good as building up a strong, deep memory. And I think that's just fundamentally wrong. I think that misunderstands the way our brains work, the way our minds work, and certainly the way memory works.
It's such an interesting question, because I mean, this is something else you write about. And I think what's really important for people to think about is that the questions that have come up with the internet are in many ways not new questions. They've been talked about for millennia. Like when the written book became a thing and largely supplanted the oral tradition in which, you know, the Iliad and the Odyssey were sung aloud and recited and so on. Since that time, there's been debate, and this comes up in one of Plato's dialogues, about whether putting information and stories and ideas and so on in written form hurts our ability to remember. If it's written down, the argument goes, you don't need to remember it. So now, as you're saying, the thinking goes that because everything is on the internet at our fingertips, we are freed from having to remember. We can turn our energy to more interesting and creative activities. First of all, it doesn't seem to work that way, but why not, and how is it different from books, about which you could make, and people have made, the same argument?
Well, you're right that Plato, in his dialogues, has Socrates bemoan the invention of writing, reading and writing, because he thought it would relieve the desire and the need to memorize things, and as a result, drain our brains of kind of the matter we have to think with. And I think there's no question that people, you know, had better memories back then before writing was invented. But I think what Socrates missed is that the invention of the book, which came later after Socrates' time, the invention of the book actually created information technology that was very, very good at encouraging us to remember things. What we know about our brains now is that paying attention is the fundamental requirement for transferring new information from our conscious mind into our long-term memory. And as I said before, that's when we connect that new information with everything else we know and have experienced, and that's the source of knowledge. So in some ways, I think Socrates' worry about writing and reading probably would have made more sense now applying it to the internet, because the way the internet works, it not only relieves us from a sense that we need to remember things, but the very way that it delivers information, you know, lots of little bursts, lots of competing messages, lots of multimedia, that very design of the technology interrupts our ability to attend to information. And as a result, we either don't remember things or we have very weak connections and associations between all the information that we do remember. So there is, you know, the technology we use to take in information, whether it's a written tablet or a written page or the internet, does have a big influence on our ability to retain the information we read, to comprehend it, and to tie it to the other stuff we know. And I think that with the internet, and particularly with smartphones and social media and stuff, as they become the new way that people take in information, it does, I fear, get in the way of our ability to not only read deeply, but to think deeply.
One of your books has an experiment where I think they gave two people the same exact story, but one of them was full of hyperlinks that they could click on, and one of them was just straight text, and the people who read the straight text, contrary to what the experimenters might have thought, understood and retained the story more deeply, even though they weren't able to click on things that theoretically could have deepened their knowledge about it. And I tested that this morning. I went on Wikipedia and just opened some random, I can't remember, some article. And it's so full of hyperlinks, I had to read it a couple of times to even see what the article was about.
I think that the whole story about hyperlinks, about links in online text is fascinating because it really reveals what's going on in our heads when we read. And when hyperlinks first arrived back in the desktop era of computers, it's true that everybody, particularly scholars and teachers and lots of educators, thought, oh, this is going to be great because students will be able to click on a link and then they'll get new information, you know, either contrary information or contextual information, and this will be great for learning. And then you look at the research that was done and you find it's exactly the opposite. Actually, people who read hyperlinked text remember less, retain less, understand less, comprehend less than people who just read straight traditional text without hyperlinks. And it turns out that the hyperlink itself, every one of those links, is a little distraction, because even though we might not be conscious of it, our brain has to interpret the hyperlink and say, you know, why is this linked? What's going to be on the other side of the link? Should I click on it? Should I not click on it? And that kind of interpretive work that our mind does gets in the way of our focused reading. So instead of learning more and retaining more when you read hyperlinked text, the evidence is, and there's quite a bit of evidence by now, that it's exactly the opposite, that actually people struggle to make sense of hypertext with links in it, and they retain less of it afterwards.
We're living in a world where you basically can't get through the day without hearing the word monetize. How much of the problem that we're talking about, the internet making us shallower and more distracted thinkers, has to do with the fact that someone is trying to make money, essentially to monetize us?
It has a lot to do with it. And it's not just, you know, making money in general somehow being bad. I don't think that's true. It's the way that internet companies like Google and Facebook and pretty much all of them monetize their content, which is by feeding us advertisements alongside it, rather than saying, you know, pay this subscription price or pay this price for a piece of software that you can then run. And what happens then is that their incentives, the Google's and Facebook's incentives, are to really bombard us with information, because the more information we look at in the more different forms, more multimedia, the more opportunities they have to show us advertisements, and equally important, the more opportunities they have to collect information about us, which then they can feed back into their advertising system and make, as they say, the advertisements more relevant. So it's, I think, the intensity of the distractions and interruptions that come to us when we're looking at our phone or online are very much tied together with the monetary incentives, the business incentives, that have become dominant in the online world and in the world of computers in general, thanks to this advertising model.
So really, there's a disincentive to have us read deeply and quietly and for a long time.
You can imagine that the worst to the big internet companies, the worst thing that can happen is somebody concentrates on one thing for a long time and doesn't get distracted by new bits of information, because whenever you do that, they're not making money. So they have no incentive to encourage contemplative or reflective thought at all. And I think that helps to explain not only how distracted we are, but how compulsive we are in wanting to constantly go online, constantly go on social media and get the latest bit of information, even if it's completely trivial.
There's another thing I was thinking about too, which is that there's so many things now that we don't do outside the house. You know, we don't go to the post office as much, or the library, or even to the movies. We don't have as many chance meetings with people. Even if we sit in a cafe, they can't see what book we're reading because it's not in book form. So then we need online services to do things that we used to do sort of all by ourselves, which is like meet people and find people to date and things like that, which is another opportunity for monetization.
Yeah, so we, you know, the unfortunate consequences, we become more and more dependent on the technology, And this is as much about our own, I think, our own laziness and willingness to kind of take the easy path and to be easily distracted and stuff. So it's not just the companies, it's also something that we're, you know, have to share part of the blame for. But I do think that the problem is you get this cycle of dependency where you can do more and more things sitting in front of a screen or through your phone. And over time, your ability to do those things yourself, or at least to have the motivation to do them, begins to erode. And then we just keep taking the easy path, you know, launch an app or click a button. And I fear, and I think I see this, and I see it in myself as well, unfortunately, that we do create this culture of dependency that over time makes us less and less willing to actually do something on our own, because it might take a little more time, it might involve some social risk or whatever. So we become, you know, one of the great hopes for the internet was that it would make us more active. And I fear it may be having the opposite effect, which is that it makes us more passive.
I mean, there's so many paradoxes. And another one, I think, is that there's so much real creativity that goes into digital media, whether it's from the creators of video games or people who are creating search engines, artificial intelligence, all kinds of software. The people who are doing that work are all engaged in a truly creative process that I think they truly believe is going to do something, make life better. But on our end, it often has the effect of making us so much less creative. So they're the creative ones. We are on the kind of, we get the short end of the stick. What do we do about that? How do you think about that?
I think it's true that, and this is completely understandable, that the great incentive for software writers, for programmers, is to find those places where we, people, are working hard, are making an effort, are spending lots of time figuring something out, and then automate those things. You know, figure out how can we insert software into this human process, whether it's a work process or a leisure process, in order to, quote unquote, free up the person's time. Unfortunately, the effect is that it steals from us these opportunities to engage in hard work and come up against challenges and figure things out. And what that ends up doing over time is it prevents us from learning new skills, because we only learn new skills when we're challenged, when we work hard, when we figure things out on our own. And second, it also, I think, steals a source of human satisfaction, because again, it's what we know from psychological research is a lot of our sense of fulfillment and satisfaction in our day-to-day lives comes from doing hard things, coming up against some challenge we've never faced before, working through it, taking time, and then solving the problem or overcoming the obstacle or whatever. And that gives us learning, and it also gives us a sense of satisfaction. So there is this fundamental tension, I think, between the desire of technology companies and programmers to make our life easier and the fact that a lot of our fulfillment in life comes from doing hard things. How we address that is very complicated. I mean, I think as people are beginning to study this, the way human beings and computers interact, they're coming up with ideas for how you might build in more challenges into software programs. But of course, then you come up against this overwhelming desire, both the tech industry and often ourselves, to take the quickest and most convenient path. So it really, I think it, solving the problem is going to require a different design sensibility on the part of the technologists, and it's going to require on the part of ourselves a willingness to do hard things and not simply revert to a piece of software that makes it easier to get through our days, but leaves us feeling kind of empty in the end.
And this is really true across many, many sectors of life, not just where software, I mean, this predates software. For example, if you think of a pizzeria where some Italian guy is spinning the dough above his head and making one of those beautiful pizza crusts versus what happens in a fast food pizza place, which requires no skill at all. Or as Michael Pollan wrote about in The Omnivore's Dilemma, industrial farming is easy, even though it's not very good for the soil and doesn't create very good food, whereas the kind of farming that really is sustainable and like closed loop farming and really is observant of nature, basically, is a lot harder, and it creates a lot better food and smarter farmers. So this is like a universal problem of technology.
It's certainly been around for a long time. And during the Industrial Revolution, and when machines were beginning to take over a lot of the manufacturing and production work, and craftspeople, in many cases, lost their jobs because they were slower than the machines. There was a term that was used often, de-skilling, this loss of skills. And you can see why companies in particular are eager to reduce the skill level of their workers, because A, they get higher output because the machines are more efficient, and B, if the people you employ don't have to have skills, then you can pay them less money because you don't have to, they don't have to be trained, they don't have to go through education, they don't have to have a lot of experience. But you run into this problem that you begin to lose people who build up knowledge about how to do any particular job, whether it's agriculture or production in a factory, or doctors doing diagnosis. You get human expertise by having lots of experience doing things and doing hard things. And so one of the dangers is that you begin to undermine people's ability to learn these very subtle and nuanced skills. And so everything might be faster and cheaper, but there's a lot of lost opportunities for having higher quality goods, for having, as you said, people who are thoughtful about what they're doing and its broader implications. And I'm not arguing that, automating work and machinery and stuff are always bad, because certainly there's lots of benefits in reducing the price of various goods. But we have to be very, very careful as we move forward to make sure that we are wise about how we divide labor and work and effort between computers, whether it's robots or algorithms or whatever, and ourselves. Because if we don't set the borders, I think we will lose this kind of subtle expertise that we take for granted now, but only after it's lost will we begin to see why it was so important.
And you give examples in, I think it's the book The Glass Cage, about airline pilots who have lost their ability to react in emergencies because they pretty much are flying on autopilot. So that's a real example of that.
Yeah, literally flying on autopilot. And these days, for commercial flights, the actual human pilot is only manually in control of the plane for a couple of minutes, a few minutes, and otherwise it's on autopilot. And the first thing that needs to be said is that historically, this has been a very good trend, because particularly in the early days of autopilots and flight automation, certainly the technology did free up pilots from a very intense, physically demanding job, so they could think more holistically about where they were going, everything that was going on the plane and stuff. And one of the very good benefits is that plane flight has gotten much, much, much safer. But recently, the picture has begun to change, in that airline regulators and experienced pilots all now point to an over-reliance on automation, on flight automation and autopilots, as more and more being the cause for accidents or close calls, for two basic reasons. One is that when you simply are flying on autopilot, you naturally lose your situational awareness. You start to tune out, and we all do this when we think a machine is going to do our work for us. We lose interest. Our mind wanders. And then if something goes wrong, and sooner or later something always goes wrong, then the pilot is disoriented and has to take time to figure out what's going on, to get their bearings back. And at the same time, and the second problem, is that because the pilots aren't getting lots of manual experience flying, skills are eroding, or at least dulling. Therefore, you create this basically a recipe for having problems when there's a technical difficulty or some other difficulty in a flight. First, the pilots have lost situational awareness, and second, their skills have eroded. And as a result, and we've seen this, in recent crashes, pilots suddenly are forced to take manual control of the plane, and they make mistakes that if they'd been paying attention and practicing a lot, they probably wouldn't have made. And in the worst cases, you know, that can lead to crashes.
Yeah. There's a quote by Marshall McLuhan that you mention. I mean, he's the media theorist who is famous for the phrase, "the media is the message." There's another quote about how the tools that we have end up weakening whatever part of the body they are kind of taking over for. So if you drive a car, your legs get weaker. And it's kind of that same kind of thing. And I think it's just really important for us to think about, like, when we get stronger by using a technology, what part of us is getting weaker and what can we do about that?
Yeah, so, his point is that every tool amplifies some part of us, makes us stronger or able to see better or whatever, but it tends to numb, and that's his word, numb. It tends to numb that particular, whatever part it's amplifying. So if, to go back to the example of a farmer, when a farmer was working the soil manually with basic tools, the farmer would tend to develop this rich sense of the soil, something that they actually felt and saw and smelled and stuff. And this was very important. Now, if the farmer is in a, closed off in a sealed off cabin in a big industrial tractor, they can do a lot more quickly, but their senses get numb. So they're not developing that rich intuitive sense of their work, not only in agriculture, but you can see it in all sorts of places. That McLuhan's point is really true, that the price we pay often for the higher productivity that comes with automation is a loss of this kind of deep experienced sense of what we're doing and our attachment, in a sense, to the world.
Right. Another effect of the internet is that it has created echo chambers, which are much talked about, that have contributed to the political polarization of our country and other countries. We tend toward media and groups that we already agree with. And I find myself wondering if part of the political polarization is not only the echo chambers, which really have been with us for a long time. I mean, there were American cities that had multiple highly partisan newspapers that came out every day and that had really that function of creating those echo chambers or maintaining them, but also the fact that we are taking less time for reflection and in-person conversation, and therefore really have less ability to think outside of our own perspectives. I wondered how you thought about that.
I think that's right. That as you say, we've known that if you give, we forgot this, but we've known that if you give people a broad choice of information, they will tend in general to collect the information that reinforces their existing point of view, reinforces their existing bias. So the ideal that the internet, by providing people with this unlimited amount of information, would encourage broad-mindedness, in most cases, and this is just human psychology, unfortunately, in most cases that's wrong. We simply have unlimited amounts of information that we can gather to reinforce our existing biases or prejudices. And then at the same time, the way the information is delivered, I think because it gets in the way of rational, contemplative, attentive thought, tends to make our reactions more visceral and more based on emotional response rather than reasoned response. And I think that just further exaggerates and amplifies this kind of polarization we're seeing, which you're absolutely right, is nothing new, but I think it's reached kind of a new level because we can now, enclose ourselves in these, what are often called filter bubbles, but also, everything becomes very, very emotional, and that kind of tends to tear people apart. We're so convinced that we're right, and we get so angry when somebody says something we disagree with, that the kind of lines of communication that were traditionally there have sort of fallen apart. So again, it's not, this is a broad social issue that goes beyond technology, but I certainly don't think the technology is helping.
When the medium of film was invented, the earliest narrative films were essentially movies of stage plays. And then they realized that, hey, this is a different medium with new possibilities. We can take it outside. And then really the film industry, you know, as we know it, was born or was invented. And I was thinking about that when I read that chapter in one of your books about the transition from television to social media as the vehicle for political campaigns. So some candidates have embraced the full power of social media and what it does best, while others have treated it as if it were kind of a version of television. Describe what this looks like and what are the dangers in a democracy where people are making decisions based on messages from Twitter and Facebook.
I think if you look back over the last 100 years, you can see how communication technologies shape both political campaigns, but also the political candidates who are successful. And this was true of radio. With radio, you wanted kind of a calm, cool, collected voice because you were coming into a person's kitchen or living room in a very intimate thing. So you get somebody like Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who was very good at that, come to the fore with TV appearance and the ability to kind of come off as a likable person. That suddenly comes to the fore. So you get people like Jack Kennedy and Bill Clinton and Ronald Reagan. With social media, you know, because it's such an emotional way to deliver information in very, very small bits, I think you tend to encourage a more extreme kind of political discourse, a more combative kind of candidate. I think we see this with Donald Trump, who has used Twitter, you know, throughout his campaign and through his presidency to communicate his point of view, but also to reinforce his base, you know, in a very powerful way. And I think this is a dangerous consequence of people coming to get more and more of their news and general civic information from things like Facebook, which were not designed for political discussions at all. But what happens is that it makes us less willing to engage in the complexity of the issues we face. And a lot of the big, tough issues we face are more complicated than ever. And yet, because the way information is delivered is in these short emotional bursts, we simply think that by, you know, clicking retweet or like or something, we're making a political statement. And that, I think, bypasses any kind of deep engagement with the complexities of the world and any willingness to work toward compromises with other people. So I do think, again, just as with radio and TV before, social media is reshaping our politics and maybe in ways that we should be worried about.
And that's the thing. I mean, there seems to be progress and, I mean, our machines get faster and our ability to do things online gets more sophisticated. And, you know, we're recording this conversation on Skype and the sound, I think, is pretty good. And each step of this process seems to be, of progress seems to be exciting. You know, this computer is better than the last one and this TV is high definition. And yet taken as a whole, I mean, each step is great, but taken as a whole, they don't really make us happier or smarter. And so I made a list while I was reading your books, and I was like, okay, what makes me happy? Like, what fulfills my life? And I was thinking, well, good conversations, good food, dancing, dogs, stories, friendship, you know, love. None of those are significantly improved by technology. And then there are things which are improved by technology, like, you know, a warm house and the ability to travel and talk to people far away and modern dentistry, you know, the washing machine. In my case, like digital editing, those are good things. They're not so much ends in themselves, but they're quality of life things. They don't make you dumber. And so we are faced with having, I think, to make a lot of personal decisions about how we use technology and really stepping back and, you know, making decisions of how to limit ourselves. And that's hard to do as an individual. It's even harder to do as a society. Like, what are your thoughts on how we can come together? I mean, you presumably have gotten a lot of feedback from all kinds of people in the public about this question.
because I've written quite skeptically and critically about particularly about, you know, the computer revolution and digital media and stuff, I often get called a Luddite or a nostalgist or whatever. This is kind of, you know, the way that people who are very invested in this idea of technological progress only producing good things, they kind of react viscerally to any kind of criticism. And that's frustrating to me because I've always really liked technology and liked innovation and new things. And what I've come to, the way I've tried to think about it myself or where I've ended up is that there are two ways to think about technology, particularly modern technologies. One is as a tool, which we use to perhaps make our lives more comfortable, but which we could also use to open up new opportunities for ourselves. A telescope makes life more interesting, as well as giving us more knowledge about our surroundings and about the universe. So technologies can open the world more fully to us and make life not only more comfortable, but more interesting and more enjoyable. Or we can look at technology not as a tool or set of tools, but as an environment in which we live. And this is very much, I think, how we think about how media operates on us. It creates this new environment in which we live. And it seems to me that that's a dangerous way to look at technology, because all too quickly, you begin to put too high of an importance on things like convenience, ease, trivial diversions. And rather than opening the world more fully to you, the technological environment begins to close off your horizons and make life actually, even if it might be more convenient and more comfortable, less interesting and less fulfilling. So I think as a society and as individuals, we've drifted into this sense that we can allow the technologists to, in essence, create our new environment in which we're going to live. And I think that's a profound mistake. And if we can back up and retake responsibility for how we use technology and how we think deliberately about using a particular tool for a particular purpose and not simply slip into this convenient, nice, mindless environment, I think we'd be much better off. Whether we can do that or not, I don't know.
Well, if I may ask, what does that look like for you?
It looks like a constant struggle because I certainly, you know, and I should begin by saying, as a writer and researcher, things like Google and online information and the web are very, very beneficial to me. I can do what used to take a lot of time and a lot of money, I can do very, very quickly. So there are a lot of good things, but I also feel this kind of the addictive quality of this endless amount of information and social, kind of social signaling and messages. And so I constantly am struggling with, as I think many people are, with how to set boundaries and how to turn off the flow of information and go back to more thoughtful reading and concentrated reading. And what I try to do is literally be more deliberate in choosing the tools or the media I use for different purposes. So I certainly use Google and stuff to find sources, but then I'll make the effort to actually get the original book or the original article and sit down away from the computer and with my smartphone in a different room to actually read in print, because I simply think that that's the better tool if your interest is understanding and comprehension. You know, one thing that I think has come out of particularly recent research is that our decision to carry our smartphones with us all day long and interact with them constantly is actually undermining a lot of our ability to think and pay attention and perceive the world and stuff. So one thing I try to do is not carry my phone with me all the time, but only carry it with me when I know that I have some practical need for it. Certainly, I'm struggling with it. I think because of the research I've done, I have a little more insight into the negative consequences and influences of the technology, and I'm trying to remedy that, but it's hard.
And what's sort of ironic to me also is that a lot of what you're talking about can be summed up in the word mindfulness. What are you paying attention to? I find myself reading the 79th article on Michael Cohen or whatever and thinking, why do I need to read this? Why am I reading it? I remember the, do you know that comedian Aziz Ansari?
Yeah.
He's a really funny guy. And he talked about, he said, you know, the internet, something about like the internet. Yeah. Suddenly I find myself needing to know everything there is to know about Joe Pesci, you know? And so, and we all do, like, I do that. And so then it's like this question of mindfulness, you know, Buddhist or other kinds of meditation. And then they're monetizing that too with apps that are on your phone to try to make you more mindful.
Yeah. I certainly think that, you know, it's good that people are thinking about mindfulness and kind of, which I think it is very much a reaction to a sense that we're simply, we've lost, the technology is stealing from us this ability to have a calm mind and be in control of our mind. So I think that's good. I mean, the problem is that it can become this trendy buzzword that you think if you run a mindfulness app for, you know, for 15 minutes a day or something, you've solved the problem. And it seems to me that we need to think critically even about mindfulness and not think that these kind of superficial responses are actually addressing the underlying problem, which is kind of the control that the technology increasingly has over what we look at, what we think about, how we make sense of things. And it's that power, I think, that the technology very, very quickly assumes over us, that's the real dangerous thing. And if mindfulness techniques can help you counter that, I think that's great. But I do think it requires, you know, something beyond running an app or two on your phone.
And maybe what it requires is something more along the lines of really being in our own bodies and doing things that are suited to our own natures, you know, that we evolved doing, like being outdoors.
Another problem with this metaphor of our minds being like computers is it misses the fact that we are creatures of the earth who are connected through our senses and through all sorts of things we don't even understand about ourselves to our physical surroundings. And I do think that one of the best antidotes for too much technology and too much digitization and digital media is taking time every day, making this part of your life to go out into the world. It doesn't have to necessarily be nature. It can be a city or whatever without your phone and just listen to your senses and kind of get that connection, that deep sensory connection that too often the media interrupts or shields us from, takes away from us, which I do think over time, you know, undermines again another one of the both the sources of satisfaction in our lives and a source of kind of calm and attentiveness. Because there's in the shallows, toward the end of the shallows, I write about these studies that show that just being out in nature in a calm surroundings can really improve your ability to resist distraction and to better pay attention. So it does seem, there does seem something very elemental to us that unfortunately we are not always sensitive to.
Nicholas Carr, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Funding learning initiatives and community programs, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And many thanks to the Lanl Foundation for support of the Radio Cafe. You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.